Support for WPR comes from Present Music, performing honest music with guest violist and curator Nadia Sirota, May 9th at 8 at the Milwaukee Art Museum. Tickets and info are at presentmusic.org.
We'll talk about what we can learn from birds. That's right, birds. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We will talk about how birding can make the world a better place. And we will find out how bird watching helped our guest get through the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina and how she says it continues to bring hope, inspiration, and a sense of wonder to her and her students. And we will welcome your questions. We will welcome your own experiences. What have you learned from birds? What have birds taught you? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Our guest is Trish O'Kane, a doctoral candidate in the Environmental Studies Department at the Gaylord Nelson Institute at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. She is a co-instructor of environmental studies, and she teaches a course in ornithology that pairs university and high school students to explore local birds. And she wrote the recent piece in the New York Times, What the Sparrows Told Me, and we have posted that on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page, and she joins us in the studio. Good morning.
Good morning.
So tell us about what the sparrows told you when you were living in New Orleans.
Well, first of all, I had just moved to New Orleans. I'd been there. My husband and I moved there in July of 2005. I had a teaching job at Loyola University, teaching journalism. We were there 28 days and just had set up the house when the storm hit and we evacuated. The house was destroyed. Our neighborhood was destroyed. It was in Spike Lee's film, Requiem for New Orleans. Oh, yeah. 90 neighbors drowned. It was,
horrible.
You saw it on TV. So I was gone from the city for a few months because the school closed, and then I returned in January to teach. And as I said, wrote in the piece for the New York Times, I had never cared about birds before Katrina. I mean, I liked them. I didn't dislike them, but I never paid attention to them. Then when I moved back to the city and I moved to a dry area, I rented a room in the back of a house, and the house had a back porch with a yard. The first few mornings I sat outside on the back stoop and I noticed, I mean, there wasn't much life in the city right after the storm. So you were always looking for signs of life. Animals, squirrels, rabbits, anything seemed like a miracle at that time. And I noticed these sparrows in the yard, and I wondered about them. You know, what did they do during the hurricane? Where did they go? How did they survive? And then I went out and bought some feeders, and that started this journey that ended here in Madison.
Yeah, and we'll talk how you got from there to here, too, and what you're doing here. But what is it when you also mentioned in the piece that birds helped your father cope with his terminal illness.
Yes. Right after Katrina, my dad was diagnosed with terminal stomach cancer. 40 days after Katrina, exactly, I got the phone call. So that was quite a shock, two things at once. And so that year after the storm, Dad was slowly dying, and he'd always liked birds. He didn't really know about them, what they were, their species. He didn't study them. But like many people, I mean, millions of people in the United States, he just enjoyed watching them, especially hummingbirds that came to his feeders. And so that last year, I went to visit him several times. And that was one of the few things he could do, because he could sit and just watch. He didn't have to walk around. He didn't have a lot of energy left. And it was very calming to him. And I was, you know, distraught, like most people in New Orleans at the time. You're trying to rebuild your life. And I just thought, well, it's helping my dad. Maybe I should try bird watching. I mean, I thought it was really strange. I thought that's something you do when you get old and you're retired. I mean, I had all the kind of stereotypical views of birders and bird watching. But those sparrows were in the yard, and I thought, well, what the heck? I'll just buy two bird feeders and sit out here and see what happens.
And what happened?
Well, I sat out there with my coffee and I watched the sparrows, you know, heckling each other and making funny noises and fighting over the seed. And I'd start to laugh. And I would be focused on them. And because I was focused on them, I'd forget everything else that was going on around me. Because at that time, that was right after the storm, the city was, you know, still in a lot of trouble and it was a mess. Now it's a much different place, thank goodness, and people have rebuilt. But at that time, it was still, every time you walked outside, there were still piles of trash, and it was very stinky, and they were still finding bodies. And so it was, you know, not an easy place to be psychologically or physically for everyone there. And people coped with it in different ways. And so I just found that before I walked to school to teach, watching these birds even for just 20 minutes, it just really calmed me down, and it gave me a different way, different perspective to go through the day. And I kind of took that with me into the classroom. I didn't really know what I was doing at the time or how it was helping me. I just started doing it.
Yeah, I can imagine that, you know, it was a touch of beauty, a touch of laughter in an extremely ugly and stressful place at the time. And I can imagine that it was a distraction, but it also taught you resilience.
Well, I started to ask questions about the birds and how they lived, and then I started reading about them and how birds just, they lose their nests all the time, nest failure. They just build another one and start laying those eggs again. And people who watch birds in Madison can see that several times in the summer. Some birds will rebuild their nests or build new nests. And so it just sort of helped me say, you know, like a lot of people in New Orleans, get on with it. You know, you just got to start rebuilding your nest and rebuilding your life. And I don't mean to anthropomorphize. I prefer to think of it as avianizing instead of anthropomorphizing. You know, what can we learn from the birds and how they live? And they just helped me get through each day with a little joy and beauty. And I think of them as flying art.
Oh, how beautiful. Yeah. So so now you are a birder.
Yes. Yes, I've joined that strange and wonderful flock of millions of people. According to the National Park Service, approximately 48 million people in the United States are birders or bird watchers of some kind. That's a lot of people. And that includes people who just sit like my father and watch their feeders, or people who get out there and do extreme birding and fly all over the world in search of, you know, a certain species that they've never seen before that they can cross off on their list. So there's a very wide variety within that 48 million people.
Yeah, and not only are you a birder, you teach a course now in an ornithology course, Birding to Change the World. Tell us about that course.
Yes, I'm very lucky because I'm a graduate student at the Nelson Institute, and they started a program to set up capstone courses that would meet community needs. And I was thinking about, I live in Brentwood on the edge of Warner Park. I've been there 7 years. It's a wonderful place to live. I love it. I'm very grateful for that place. But when I moved there, talking to alders and community leaders, found out about some problems in the neighborhood with crime and a need for activities for young people. And we're living on the edge of this gorgeous park, which I soon discovered was full of birds because I started doing research in the park. So at the same time the Nelson Institute was setting up these courses for graduate students to teach, I realized there was a need in my neighborhood, and that's how the course started. So I started the course. It was called Birding to Change the World. Now the official title is Last Child in the Park, How Kids and Birds Can Save the Planet. And the text is Richard Louv's book, Last Child in the Woods. That's why that name for the course. But Birding to Change the World, the idea was there's a community need that needs to be met. And there's this green space and there are these birds. And so we've got birds and we've got kids who need something to do. Why don't we put those two things together? And then we've got really wonderful environmental studies students at the Nelson Institute, undergraduates, who want a community-based learning experience because they need jobs. Some of them want to go into environmental education. They want to work for environmental organizations. Some of them have a lot of experience working with children. They tutored when they were in high school or they were camp counselors. Many of my students have far more experience working with kids than I do. I had never worked with kids before. I'd worked with high school students. I set up a service learning program for Auburn University years ago in Alabama. But now we're working with middle school students at Sherman Middle School. And I knew nothing about middle schoolers, but I found that my undergraduate students in environmental studies knew a lot, some of them, about middle school kids. And so this pairing, this mentoring program, I teach the course in the mornings at UW. We use the Lakeshore Preserve as our bird lab, and that's where we teach the outdoor part of the course, bird identification. We teach that to the college students every Wednesday morning, and then Wednesday afternoon at 2:45, we take the class to Sherman Middle School, and we meet with the kids there. We started with 6 kids at Sherman Middle School the first semester. Last year, I registered 76 for this club. It has just grown. This is the 5th year. Fortunately, the 76 never show up on the same day, or all my hair would have fallen out by now, because that's a lot of kids.
So these kids are... They're going out and they're bird watching and they're doing the things that the old folks do.
Yes, in a different way. Mm. It's not quite the staid, quiet birding scene that you might imagine. So we leave Sherman Middle School at 2:45 and walk to Warner Park, which is about 15 minutes away. So they get a walking field trip exercise. They have binoculars that Madison Audubon helped me get and North Face. I got a grant. And so Sherman Middle School has binoculars in their library that the kids get to check out. And we got them discounted from Eagle Optics in Middleton. And thank you to Eagle Optics for supporting our program, too. So we walk to the park, and then the kids walk around with their college mentors. Some of them look at birds. Some of the kids, frankly, aren't interested in birds at all. They just want to be outside. And as soon as they enter that meadow, they start running and screaming and jumping up and down and grabbing flowers and throwing milkweed seeds in the air. You just feel this sort of explosion of energy and joy, because they're sitting down most of the day. I mean, this is something our schooling system, Sherman is a fabulous school. They get the kids out running around the playground. They try to get them outside and to do physical activities, but we have a severe winter. So this is one of the very few after school programs that goes through the winter. We take the kids to the park. In February, we are there, 2 feet of snow, building snow forts and looking at birds. But so it's not just about birding. The program's called Nature Explore. So the course is the birding course, and the afternoon session is a service learning component called Nature Explorers Club. And I was just at Sherman yesterday. I'll be back there today registering kids. We had 31 kids sign up just yesterday. I expect another 30 today. So
excellent. Well, we'll talk more about how this program can help the kids and help the world for that matter. And we'll welcome your questions for our guest, Trish O'Kane. Trish is a journalist turned environmentalist turned university professor. We're welcoming your questions for her about how birding can help us in many different ways. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Are you a birder? Do you like spending time in nature? What do you love about it? What does birding teach you that you can apply to other areas of your life? Does it change your outlook on life in any way? I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. We are talking about what we can learn from birds and how birding can make the world a better place with our guest, Trish O'Kane. She wrote a piece that we noticed in the New York Times this week, What the Sparrows Told Me. And we found out that she is not a university professor. She is a co-instructor of environmental studies, a graduate student in environmental studies at the Gaylord Nelson Institute at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. She does teach a course in ornithology. that pairs university and middle school students to explore nature and local birds. And you are writing your dissertation on how birding can make the world a better place. And tell us, Trish, why it can make the world a better place.
Well, the idea came from my research in Warner Park, and I live right across the street from the park. I took ornithology here at UW-Madison with Mark Barra's fabulous class, Ornithology 521, years ago. And part of our homework was to go out and spend an hour, at least a week, looking at birds. So since Warner Park's across the street, I started doing that there. I was astounded to find pretty quickly I found like 86 species within the first few months. Now we're up to 135 different species. And I realized, wow, this place is full of birds. And not only that, a lot of them are long-distance migrants that winter in Latin America. And as I was spending more and more time in the park, now I've spent over 500 field hours in there studying the birds, people started to come up to me and talk to me and ask me what I was doing and sharing their own bird stories. And I noticed also we have red foxes in the park, and at community meetings, neighborhood association meetings, people tell fox stories. Oh, I saw the fox. Mm-hmm. It was going to get the chickens in the chicken people's yard. And oh, the fox was in my yard, and or skunk stories. And I started thinking about how animals in cities can help us build community and social capital. And so I focus on birds because birds are probably one of the most accessible forms of urban wildlife. I mean, a kid walking down the street to school can see a sparrow in a hedge, crows, right, flying over the playground, hawks soaring high in the air, even birds. I know at one of the elementary schools here, I think it was Lakeview or Sherman, a red-tailed hawk caught a squirrel and ate it right in front of a classroom window. Ooh. With all the kids watching. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, there's a kind of a democratic element to birds. Anyone can watch birds. You don't have to have binoculars or expensive gear. You can just step outside and hear one and then go find it.
Yeah, it's something. And it also, it just seems to me that it does sort of, there's certainly many learning moments with watching the birds, but it connects us with the world. And it connects us. I mean, these birds, a lot of them make a pretty long journey, and we can find out, that, they call it this home part of the time.
Yes, I became very interested in that topic when I first moved here, and there was a gray catbird in my yard. When I first moved to Madison, I had two large dogs who unfortunately were serial cat killers.
Oh.
And I heard this bird in the yard meowing. Well, I didn't know it was a bird.
Yeah.
I heard something meowing in my yard, and I thought, oh, my God, there's a cat. They're going to kill this cat. And ran in the yard to keep my dogs away from the cat, and then I find this gray bird up there in this bush meowing. I'm like, what is that? I've never seen one before. Now I study that bird, and my ornithology advisor and I placed geolocators on 15 catbirds from Warner Park, gray catbirds. Her name is Dr. Anna Pigeon. These are tiny backpacks. They're about thumbnail size. We did this two summers ago. And the 15 catbirds took off. We didn't know where they went. The objective of the research is to find out where do they go and what are their route maps. And I wanted to know specifically, do the catbirds go some of the places I've called home, like Guatemala, Mexico, and New Orleans and Alabama? I've lived in all those places, and I started reading about the birds, and I thought, I want to know, where do our catbirds go? The next summer, we recaptured four of them and took the geolocators and ran the data and found out that, in fact, our preliminary data strongly indicates that the catbirds of Warner Park, some of them at least, do winter in southern Mexico and in northern Guatemala. The route maps show them flying right down the Mississippi Flyway, crossing over New Orleans, crossing the Gulf of Mexico, and heading south.
Well, they pretty much have been everywhere you've been.
Yes, and that was I answered my research question. And this is something I want to share with the children and my undergraduate students. That gray bird you see sitting in that perched in that honeysuckle bush leaves here in September, October, and this is where he goes. He goes to Mexico or Guatemala, probably. And many of the kids in our program are Latin American or Mexican American or Central American. And so this is a way of showing them, too. You see, these birds from Madison, they're also Latin American birds, and they live in two different places, two different cultures.
Oh, how fascinating. You know, since you brought it up, we have many callers, and I want to get to them. But since you mentioned a lot of your young birders are from Latin America, let's talk a little bit about the demographics of birding. Maybe it's changing. We do have that stereotype of mm-hmm. the older, white, affluent person mm-hmm. as the person who is the birder. And is that still the case? Mm-hmm. Is that changing?
Well, according to the statistics in the United States, that's still the case. But it's interesting, some of the emails I've gotten about the New York Times piece, one was from a Guatemalan sharing with me that for Mayan people, birds are extremely important and have helped many people deal with tragedies over the last several centuries, including some of the massacres that I mentioned in the New York Times piece. That birds, for Mayans, birds have individual stories to tell, and so this is cross-cultural. So I think maybe the stereotype of the birder, that's unfortunately still true. That's something I want to change. I think that's something the kids themselves are changing. But culturally and historically, that has not been the case. And people have always been, they've always looked to the skies. In many cultures, people have seen birds as angels or, you know, as messengers.
We are talking with Trish O'Kane. She is a graduate student. She teaches or co-instructs a course in ornithology. And we are talking about birding for a better world. And we're welcoming your thoughts, your questions, your own experiences. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. What do you gain from birding if you are indeed a birder? Why do you love birds? What do you learn from birds? And what do you think of this program that Trish is doing, getting young kids involved in nature and bird watching? Yvonne in La Crosse is with us. Hello, Yvonne.
Hello.
Yes, go ahead.
I just wanted to thank you for bringing or having the speaker today, because I am a peer specialist and I work in a crisis unit for people with mental health crisis. And one of the things that we do is encourage a wellness recovery action plan and ways and finding ways that we can feel better about ourselves when we're not feeling well. And this is awesome, because I saw how much it helped my dad when he was having difficulties with dementia to be able to watch the birds. And people that are really struggling, you know, have their bird feeders, and, oh, I had three jonquils today or whatever, jonquils. And this type of thing is really, really healthy, because it's connecting spiritually, too, which is important in recovery from mental health.
Wow.
And wellness. And the being connected to the universe, to nature, and being able to resonate with that, there's just so much it has to offer. And I'm just real excited, because it's something else I can offer people to consider, to put in their wellness toolbox, and what to do when they are feeling bad or triggered or having problems.
Oh, Bon, thank you for sharing that. That's any reaction, Trish?
Yes. Thank you, Yvonne. That resonates really deeply with me. I mean, that's exactly what happened to me in New Orleans. And I did not know what I was doing again when I sat down and started watching those sparrows. And then I found the same thing with my students at Loyola when I took them to Audubon Park across the street from Loyola in New Orleans. And they started watching the ducks. And some of my Loyola students wrote in their papers that watching the ducks reminded them of their childhood, of a much happier time when they went to feed the ducks with their parents, and you know, when their homes weren't destroyed, when their parents had jobs, and when they weren't thinking, how am I going to pay for the next semester of college, and all that stuff. And so it took them back, it calmed them down, and some of them became addicted to watching those ducks. I mean, that's literally how they got through the semester. And I've seen it here in Madison, too, with both my college students. Some of them, they write in their reflection papers and journals that watching the birds just 1 hour a week helps them deal with the stress of college and financial stresses or personal stresses. It gives them a quiet time. And then I see it also with the kids from Sherman. Some of them, you know, they've been diagnosed with ADHD and all of these things we're hearing about the kids. And we get them into the park, and within a few weeks, these kids that are supposedly troubled are no trouble for us at all. They're great. They just need to climb a tree and watch a fox or a bird and just leave them alone and let them muse for a while or scream or whatever it is they need to do. And definitely, I agree with you, Yvonne. It's a really important mental health tool that's right there for us.
Yvonne, thanks very much. And I also like the point she made about how it's something you can do, you know, by yourself, but the fact that there it was a social activity or people would talk about it that would, you know, connect you with other people just through the conversation. Let's go to Jan in Milwaukee next. Hi, Jan.
Hi. I am so delighted about this program and about the article. The excitement in Trish's voice, no wonder kids are going to gravitate toward this. You've got passion and excitement. My story is about post-Katrina Louisiana. I went to New Orleans 9 months after Katrina, interviewed some people there, and they said, what hope is there for us when even the birds are gone? It was truly a silent spring when I was there. There was not one sound. Bird songs are the ambient background sound of our lives, and we don't even know it. But when they're gone, the desolation is so profound. I kept up a correspondence with a woman who lived in the Ninth Precinct, and she wrote one note to me and said, there is hope. I saw a sparrow today.
Oh, wow. Yeah, that's powerful. And did you experience that silence too, Trish?
Well, that's interesting because I went back 4 months after the storm, and the first morning I woke up, that was what I heard, silence. And then after a few minutes, I lay there in bed listening, thinking this is so weird because you're in this huge city. I mean, it used to be a huge city, right? This is when there was only probably about a quarter of the people back or something. After several minutes, then I heard a cardinal clicking in the yard. I mean, I didn't know what the clicking was, but I heard this clicking, and then I realized, oh, that's a cardinal, because I knew that bird. And then the bulldozers started beeping, and that was pretty much our soundtrack for the first several months in the city was bulldozers. But the first thing was that cardinal. To me, that was a sound of hope.
Yeah, birds equal hope. Thank you very much, Jan. Let's go next to Doris in... I'm not sure where you're from, Doris. Where are you from?
Burlington.
Burlington. Wisconsin. Okay, go ahead.
I had been teaching for 43 years, and I would love to commend you because you're getting the kids out and doing things. Mm-hmm. They spend way too much time in classrooms, in desks, not paying attention to nature. And they don't play outside the way that we did when I was a kid. And I was coordinating gifted and talented program for a while, and the parents were, well, what can I sign them up for this summer? I said, take them outside. Let them experience things. You know, they are just entirely way too much programmed and not in contact. By being outside, they will be in contact with nature. The issues of climate change will mean something to them. And I could go on and on. I once was working on a dissertation about physical exercise is a way to develop the brain. Because I saw a child raise their reading score 6 years within 1 year by doing certain physical exercises. And, you know, just everything you're doing is wonderful.
Thank you very much, Doris. So you have no doubt that kids are suffering from nature deficit disorder, Trish?
Well, compared to when I grew up, I mean, I don't mean to sound like an old timer, but I definitely think there's a huge difference. Even my college students notice it. They're only, you know, 20, 21, and they notice that these kids that are 13 or 14, they write this in their papers, are already living a very different life than they had in their childhoods. And part of it is related to race and class and who gets to go outside and what neighborhoods and parks are safe to play in. And I think that is something we can do something about. So yes, I do think there is a problem, but there is a cure. And thank you, Doris, mm-hmm. for your wonderful comments. I want you to know there's a lot of hope. In Madison, there's a lot more people doing this. I'm just one of a growing army. The elementary school, Lakeview Elementary School, which feeds into Sherman Middle School, there's a wonderful teacher there named Susie Hobart, who contacted me 2 years ago and asked to start a birding lunchtime club. One of my students volunteered, Paige Sandusky was her name. She was just learning birds herself. She started that club. So now there is a birding club also at an elementary school. And I know that there are a lot of teachers in Madison that try to get the kids outside. It's just we need to change our education system so it's not so difficult for teachers to schedule and program those activities, because we have fabulous green spaces all over Madison. We have more parks per capita than a lot of cities our size. So the opportunities are right outside the door.
Yeah, so as part of the hope here, the purpose here, birding for a better world, to get more people, young people included, caring about birds, caring about nature, and therefore perhaps caring about things like climate change.
Well, I think it's about connecting and noticing things first. Most of us are moving so fast, myself included, before Katrina, that we move through the world without really seeing it. And we're walking outside and we're not in that place. We're on our phone or our mind is somewhere else. And I mean, I see so many people with the earphones on, even on campus. And in my class, I teach my students to listen to the soundscape. They have to do soundscape exercises where they have to sit outside, you know, for 3 minutes, which is hard for some of them, believe it or not, with their eyes closed and do nothing but listen and then list the sounds. And my college students are astounded to find what an urban soundscape they live in on campus, how noisy it is. And then they have to compare that to a soundscape in Warner Park or the Lakeshore Preserve. One of the reasons I believe in teaching the soundscape, and it's an exciting realm of ecology that's just being explored, is this is one way to look at climate change and how we're changing also the noise levels. I mean, birds that sing in a city, they have to sing much louder to compete with our noise levels and our transportation systems. And that takes them a lot more energy. They have to eat more food, you know, can lower their lifespan, the number of years they live, just because they have to work that much harder. And the way climate change is affecting birds, you can see it if you watch birds over several years. More southern birds are moving farther north. I mean, people know there weren't so many cardinals here in Wisconsin 50 years ago. I mean, that's a bird that's moving further north. Mockingbirds are also moving further north. So, I mean, the birds are responding to the change in climate and the change because there's a change in their food supply. So if you watch birds over long periods of time, you can definitely see the impacts of climate change.
We are talking with Trish O'Kane. She is telling us how bird watching helped her get through the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina, how this changed how she worked and how she lived, and telling us about the program, the course that she co-instructs. She is a co-instructor of environmental studies. She teaches a course in ornithology. And she pairs university students with middle school students to explore birds and nature. And we're talking about birding for a better world and welcoming your thoughts, your questions. How can birding make this a better world? What have you learned from birds? And are you a big birder? What about your kids? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also go to the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page to see Trish's piece that ran recently in the New York Times, What the Sparrows Told Me. This is the Ideas Network. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine, talking with our guest about birding and how birding can help us, how birding can make this world a better place, what we can learn from birds. And we welcome your thoughts and questions for her at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Trish O'Kane is a doctoral candidate in environmental studies at the Gaylord Nelson Institute of the University of Wisconsin-Madison. We have so many callers. Let's go to Candace in Shawano. Hi, Candace.
Hi. I have a quick question for you, and you were just talking about birds reacting to climate change. And last night I heard geese, and I heard them again this morning, and I was astounded. I thought, isn't it early for geese to be honking around Shawano? And I'll go offline and just listen for your answer. Thank you.
Can you handle that one, Trish?
Well, I'm not an expert on geese, so no. Mm-hmm. But I do notice, you know, acorns are falling. There are signs that our summer is slipping away quickly. So I do not know if the geese are already starting to move, but it's possible. That's a question you could direct to the UW Wildlife Ecology Department. They have people there that study geese. Sorry.
Linda on Facebook writes, as Sauk Prairie is a bird city, and we have a Facebook page, Birders of Sauk Prairie, I believe I would agree that in the winter, we're definitely kept sane by our birds. I love listening to the songs, to the colors that they bring to the winter, mostly somewhat duller than spring and summer. And the spring brings so many birds through the area, Baltimore Orioles, Scarlet Tanagers, and so many hummingbirds. I am a bird fancier. So, again, just someone who the birds bring color and joy to our lives. Let's go next to Rich in Milwaukee. Hi, Rich.
Hi, Joy. I think you picked a really great animal for a project such as this, and I don't think that there could be much better animal to bring, you know, tranquility and interactiveness with nature. I mean, I think it's a really great project you guys are doing. I've got a friend, my best friend, he's a biology teacher of the MPS system in Milwaukee here, and I don't think he could even get something like this off the ground. I mean, his hands are tied as far as, you know, creativity and stuff like that, but I think it's really great.
Well, I know you don't know what how bureaucracy in Milwaukee, but I'm wondering if you have some thoughts on how other communities, other people might start up similar programs to what you're doing.
Well, yes, I do have some thoughts on that, and thank you, Rich, and I sympathize with your friend. I hear this from many teachers, and I see how tired they are and how hard they're working. That's the first thing coming from the university and going into a middle school and spending time there. My students, my college students, too, are shocked at how schools have changed and how many things teachers and school staff have to do. I mean, Sherman literally has a room where they gather donated clothing so they can clothe kids that come to school without a jacket in the winter. They're feeding them breakfast now, too. I mean, schools are providing all kinds of social services that used to be provided by, you know, local governments or, you know, families that could afford to provide those services and can't anymore because people aren't making a living wage. And there's a little plug to whoever becomes mayor. We need $15 an hour minimum wage in Madison. That would change some of the kids' lives. Some of the kids in my program would change their lives more than birding. Their parents would have decent jobs. But your question was, how do teachers do this? Sherman has a great model. The principal there, Mike Hernandez, is he's a super principal, a superhero principal. I couldn't have done this without him. He came to community meetings and asked for help, and I heard him speak at a neighborhood association meeting. I did not want to work with middle school kids. I thought, they're too squirrely. I have no experience. I want little kids who I can control or big high school students who are mature, not middle school kids. But he was so impressive that I went and met with him and threw out this bird club after school club idea. And his sister works at Cornell University, and they have the premier lab of ornithology. So he said, I get the bird thing. Let's do this. Let's try it. It could be a hit. And he has set up at Sherman Middle School, I think as many as 30 after-school clubs. The kids get bowling. They get horseback riding, all kinds of sports. He has really reached out to the community and created this model for after-school clubs to give kids positive things to do. So even if the teachers can't do this during the day and they're restricted by the core curriculums and all these testing regimes, he's created an after-school space to do a lot of really cool stuff.
Very neat. I talk a little bit more about what these middle school kids, these kids who, and if I'm not mistaken, many of them do come from a lower socioeconomic background.
Yes. Well, I live, as I said, in Brentwood, which is walking distance from Sherman. Some of the kids in the program live in my neighborhood down the street, around the corner from me. Brentwood is on the north side of Madison, which has several lower income neighborhoods surrounding Warner Park. So yes, most of our kids in the program actually are for lower income families. Over half are children of color. I could just tell one story about what the birds mean to some of these kids, and you just never know what they're thinking. One day I went to Sherman Middle School. I was going to the lunches. I go to visit the kids once a week and remind them, you know, my college students are coming this Wednesday, get your jackets, all that stuff. And I was walking down a hallway, and a little boy from Puerto Rico dashed out of the classroom, and his teacher was yelling at him, "Where are you going? Where are you going?" And he said, "I have to talk to her. It's a bird emergency." And the teacher looked at me like, "What? Who are you?" And I went and apologized to her, but he was so insistent, "I have to take you outside. I have to show you something. It's a bird emergency." And the teacher said to me, "It's okay. He can have 5 minutes." And so she let him leave the building, which they usually don't do. And he took me out to the playground, and it was in February, I think, and it was totally frozen. And he took me to the swing set, and he pointed at the ground, and I could see below the ice, about a foot below the ice, there was a black spot. Uh-oh. And he said, "Trish," he said, "that's a crow. It's trapped in there. We saw it during recess. We saw it move." And he said, "We need to get it out of there. It's still alive."
Oh, my goodness.
I know. And I stood there and I looked down at it. I thought, it's not a crow. It's a spot. But what do I tell this boy? I was so touched that he was so worried about it.
He wanted to save the crow.
And he wanted to save the crow. And he was sure it was a crow. You know, and these kids have beautiful imaginations. They're still children. I think he was in sixth grade. So I explained to him, "Look, it's not a crow. Let's get closer. Let's look down there. It's maybe something trapped in there, but it's not alive. It couldn't be alive. It's frozen. And maybe it's a piece of wood." But I was so, you know, impressed that he ran out of his classroom risking getting in trouble to run outside the building because he wanted to save a bird.
Yeah. And, you know, that tells me that you're helping teach with this program compassion and kindness.
Well, I think that's been proven that, you know, animals, having pets, teaches all of us compassion and kindness. And yes, the kids, they when they go into the meadow and they see grasshoppers, they start picking up their feet and they see toads. So they don't want to step on them. And they tell the college students, they tell all of us, you know, "Be careful. Don't step on the bugs," or, you know, "Don't hurt the grasshoppers or the crickets." So some of the kids are really, really have deep empathy for all the creatures living around us.
More calls. Lois in DeForest is with us now. Hi, Lois.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. I couldn't help but notice from the last caller, I try to take care of birds and the monarch butterfly, and I would have people come in my yard, and I would say, "Watch where you step, because the monarch caterpillar may be crawling to build its chrysalis." At any rate, the reason I called is because in my backyard, I was feeding the Baltimore Orioles the grape, Concord grape jelly, and the gray catbird came to the same table. And then when the monarch or the Oriole left, the gray catbird kept coming to the Concord grape jelly. And so that was one way I was able to see a new species that I had never seen before. So I wanted to just mention one thing, that when people let their cats out, it really does change the whole dynamic for people who do enjoy nature. And I wish that that could be thought about, you know, by cat people. I'm a cat person, so.
No. I'm a cat person too. Ray stays inside. But Lois, and we'll talk about that. But I wanted to get back to your catbird story. So you were thrilled to see the catbird feeding on the grape jelly that was there for the Orioles.
I kept the grape jelly out longer after the, you know, Baltimore Orioles had left. And I've talked with many people, sometimes in the grocery line, and we'll even talk about that. They might be buying a certain type of bird feed. And so, but also I was so impressed with Trish talking about, the geolocation of birds. I was 2 years ago, 3 years ago, in Guatemala building a house for a Mayan family. And so there was such a strong connection there, the catbird, the gray catbird. I guess I won't forget this. getting to know a little bit more about a Mayan family when, you know, there are so many cultural differences between us and yet so many very common.
Wow, I'm glad I asked.
Yes, Lois, thank you for that wonderful catbird story. I really love catbirds so much because they're mimics, and they don't have their own song. They mimic other birds' songs. I don't know if you knew that. And so when our catbirds return from Guatemala and Mexico and come back to Madison, some of them will be singing the songs of other Central American birds. Now, they can also imitate car alarms. They can sound like crying babies. If you have been woken up at 4 a.m., the catbird that comes back to my yard every year, it's a him because it's the males that make the most noise. He usually announces himself about 4 a.m. April 27th, 28th, 29th, or maybe in May. And I hear him, I wake up and I think there's a demented feathered punk band outside in my yard, and it's him saying, "I'm here. Yeah, wake up."
I'm sorry that we didn't pull some audio of that. That would have been great.
Yes.
We were talking about whether we should put little bird songs in this hour, and we might have, but we thought, well, you know, it's more than that, but that's interesting. That's fun. What about, do you have a comment on the cats?
Yes. Professor Stanley Temple, he's retired now from university, did a study on cats and concluded that letting your cat go outside is one of the major causes of bird mortality. They kill millions, if not billions, of birds every year because the cat's not native to North America and birds haven't adapted to deal with that predator. And so I love cats, too. I have two dogs. It's just better for your cat to keep the cat inside, and also better for the birds, definitely better for the wildlife. The birds are already in serious trouble. We've lost 50% of our birds in the last, I think, 50 years, according to the government report, State of the Birds. Common bird numbers are also dropping, and climate change, and birds are just having to deal with so many difficulties. Cell towers, birds are flying into them when they migrate. Catbirds crossing the Gulf of Mexico, they're nocturnal migrants. They migrate at night, and any bird that migrates at night is going to be attracted by lights, and it's going to be blown off course, or it's going to fly to the lights, and they'll fly round and round the cell towers until they drop in exhaustion, or they'll fly into the tower. And ornithologists and avian ecologists find dead birds around the base of cell towers. This is something that's being studied. So keep your cats inside. You'll help the birds because they already have way too many things to deal with, especially those that travel thousands of miles.
Well, we have just a minute to go. What are your hopes for your students and younger generations of birders in a minute?
Right. Some of the kids that we work with and my students, they want to be biologists or zoologists or go into some kind of science. So I definitely hope it's a program that can attract kids to the sciences. But more than that, I think we all need just a sort of a basic working literacy of how the planet works. I mean, to walk outside and understand our connections between ourselves and the creatures that live around us, if we don't understand that or know something about it or learn, you know, we're in trouble. I mean, we're already in trouble. And the other thing is, for my students and for the kids, I give them the birds as a way to get through the day, just as it helped me get through the day. And they don't have to become experts in the birds or even learn much about them, but they just know it's a resource that's there, that the bird is a resource for them. They can walk outside, or that tree. Some of the kids love trees so much.
And I wish we had more time.
Sorry.
Hope you'll come back sometime.
All right, thank you.
Trish O'Kane. I'm Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network.